Good morning, everybody. Thank you for joining us. Before I introduce our guests, I just want to say Law Matters does not endorse that law firm that was just advertising on my show. So there. On the phone we don't have anybody in the studio today. On the phone we have former Congressman Colby. How are you?
I'm fine. Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing great. And also on the telephone, we have Andy from the FBI. He's calling in from Florida. Good morning, Andy.
Good morning, Sherry.
How's it going?
Good, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing okay. I need to turn my speaker up. Okay, I want to start with the FBI has a Protective Voices initiative. Can you explain that to us?
Sure. This is simply a way to help protect your voice in the context of the vote that you cast in this upcoming election. There's a lot of foreign actors that are out there, primarily Russia and China, but other countries, including Iran, that are trying to illegally influence public opinion and thereby influence this upcoming election. And it's important for people to know how prolific these efforts are by our foreign adversaries and what they can do to protect themselves against those illegal malign foreign influence operations.
So how do we go about doing that? What do we need to look for?
The FBI really recommends three rather simple practices for people to follow. And this is in the context of reading any kind of information that is put out there, whether it's about the election itself, in terms of the time and place of voting for the election, or for social issues or issues that are the subject of this upcoming election. Obviously, we have two different parties, two different candidates with very different views, and our foreign adversaries are out there trying to influence people largely by creating disinformation, meaning flooding the information space with reports that simply are not accurate or untrue. And it's interesting because in many cases, our foreign adversaries don't necessarily have a particular agenda. They may not favor a particular party or particular candidate. They simply want to just sow discourse among the voting members of the United States and just cast a shadow of doubt about the integrity of our election process and thereby undermine our democratic process. So the FBI recommends that everyone out there should be as well informed as possible. It's a concept that we call media literacy. And that concept of media literacy really has three different principles. The first is to read beyond the headline. And what that means is consider the motivation of the person that posts this particular information on the website.
Okay.
Perhaps they have an ulterior motive for why they are saying what they are saying. The second is to check the facts. Because you read something on the internet, and this goes for anything, not just related to the election, but if you read something on the internet, check it against another source, preferably a bona fide, well-established and vetted news media source to find out whether that information is accurate. And the third piece of that media literacy idea is vetting the source. And what that means is try to determine if this person is who they say they are. And the reason why that last point is important is because we have had hundreds of examples, if not thousands of examples, of foreign individuals acting at the direction of foreign governments that have taken on online personas, claiming to be U.S. citizens when in fact they're from foreign countries, and they are trying to influence public opinion. And the reason why they take on these U.S. personas is because they think that the positions, the points that they're trying to make are going to be more credible if they are sound like they're U.S. citizens as opposed to foreign nationals.
So this isn't a situation where, you know, the misspelling and everything. These people are highly educated and they know that they're causing confusion and chaos with the citizens of America. And
Absolutely. This isn't somebody from their basement that's just got a bone to pick with the government or a political candidate or party. These are well-orchestrated essentially companies, if you will, that are engaging in widespread disinformation efforts. There's a quite a fascinating case back from 2018 that deals with Russian interference in the 2016 election, and this information is public. And if you're interested, it's a three-page press release that the Department of Justice issued after 13 Russian individuals were indicted in February of 2018. And so, again, this is public information, and it just takes a few minutes to read over it, and it just lays out almost like the script of a movie or a book how this Russian organization called the Internet Research Agency was utilized to engage in widespread, well-organized, well-funded disinformation campaign with the goal being to influence the 2016 presidential election.
Where can they find that if somebody wants to read it?
It's on the FBI.gov as well as DOJ.gov. And the name of the press release is Grand Jury Indicts 13 Russian Individuals and three Russian companies for scheme to interfere in the United States political system. So all you need to do is you can just do an internet search for Russian indictment 2016 election, and that should bring up this press release. And there's, of course, a number of media articles that were published about this press release. And again, it's quite fascinating to read through it because of how it lays out these different schemes. One of the most sort of interesting pieces that I found personally as I was reading through this was, according to this indictment, which it hasn't been proven yet in court, but the indictment claims that this Internet Research Agency set up two opposing demonstrations in the same city on the same day.
Just so by advertising it online.
Exactly. So these claimed to be sort of grassroots demonstrations that just sort of spontaneously came up by these two opposing sides for whatever political issue was at hand. And obviously it wasn't a coincidence. This was well planned. So they tried to get these two, again, apparent grassroots movements together in the same location at the same time. And there was only one purpose for that effort. It was just to cause strife between those two groups and inflame these already sort of passionate views that people had about this particular issue.
Do you think something like that is happening, like in Portland and Seattle, in some of the other cities that have been, you know, hit with riots?
That is certainly possible. With this current political and social climate that we have right now, I sort of think of it as a tinderbox. It's just an area that is just unfortunately very susceptible, even more so than it has been in the past, because these foreign influence operations aren't anything new. But this current political and social climate is really the perfect storm for our foreign adversaries to make these already tense social issues that much more damaging and divisive.
Okay, I want to ask the congressman, isn't it the Washington's responsibility, the congressmen and the senators, isn't it their responsibility to hold it down and spew through the rhetoric and expect people to behave and tell their constituents that this is wrong and this is right?
Well, Sherry, I think it's absolutely the responsibility of all of us, and certainly starts with at the very top with our leaders in Congress, in the White House, to tone down the rhetoric and to make it a more civil discussion. That's what we're lacking in this country right now. And in fact, there's an organization at the University of Arizona that I've been working with, the National Institute for Civil Discourse, that came about in the wake of Gabby Giffords' shooting, that is trying to get both sides to talk to each other and have a civil discourse to, as you say, tone down the rhetoric. And I think that, unfortunately, we've had a president who has not been doing very well at toning that down. And it exacerbates it, leads to it. But we all have this responsibility. It's not just one person. It's not just one individual in Congress. We all have this responsibility to tone down the rhetoric that we have and to, as Andy was saying, get our information from different sides. I would just add to what he said that, in addition to vetting the different sources of information, don't just rely on a single source of information. Get different sources of information. Don't just have a narrow blinder view of one network or another network on television to get your news. One of the channels, just try to watch different ones and read different newspapers and different magazines.
Yeah, you want to listen to what everybody's saying, because I think it's more important to listen to what they're not saying, too. One station is giving verbal explanation on one thing, and the next station doesn't even talk about it.
Exactly.
That's an issue.
That's right. There is a great deal of subjectivity in the way the news is cast by broadcasters. It's what they decide to pick and what kind of headline they put on it, how they lead it off. So there is that, and you just have to kind of sift through all that. And the best way to do it is it takes time, but get more information from more different sources.
Do you think the laws are going to change for future elections after the last couple of elections, with everything that's been going on?
Well, I think there's probably going to be some move to try to, in a lot of states, to change the laws so that they are more, either not necessarily uniform, because I don't think we're headed yet in that direction towards a national uniform standard for elections, but that at least they change the law so that it's possible for people to know that their vote is going to be cast and recorded and counted in a reasonable fashion. The problem in a lot of states is they have deadlines, because we didn't have much early voting. They have deadlines that are way too short, too close to the election. In New York, for example, you could request a absentee ballot up to Friday before the election. Get the absentee ballot to somebody and then to get it back in 3 days is virtually impossible. So they've got to change some of these timetables that they have. And I think they're going to see with the huge amount of mail-in absentee voting, I think we're going to see that. I think we're also going to see more states go to the now 9 states that have entirely mail-in voting. In other words, everybody's the registered voter, gets their ballot and votes it.
I didn't realize we had states that did just mail-in.
Yeah. There's been 4 all along. There's been Oregon, Washington, Nevada, Utah, and now California's added to that. New Jersey, Connecticut, and I'm missing a couple of others have been added to that. Everybody's getting their ballot in the mail there. And there are other states like Arizona. I think Arizona's got it about right, frankly. You get on a permanent early voting list, so you say, as I am, I want my ballot sent to me each time, and it just automatically is sent to me. But you have to request that you get on that early voting list.
Yeah, I've been on that list for a long time.
Yeah, but you have to have it in. I think the key is you have to have it in before the by election day so that it can be counted. It's an irony, I think, that Democrats right now are pushing for votes to be counted later. In other words, for them to be received after election day, 3 days, and I think in a couple of cases they've got it up to a week now, and even 10 days after the election is over, where they can still get ballots in the mail. And the problem with that is, first of all, you can't tell whether it's been postmarked, because most of the things don't have postmarks on them,
right,
whether it's been postmarked in time. And secondly, it just leads to the other side being able to say, see, these ballots, we can't trust these ballots are coming in so late. So I think you have to have deadlines are important. I think you have to have deadlines.
And they keep moving the goalpost here.
Moving the goalposts. Yeah.
And it's like one day it's, you know, I announced, hey, that's your deadline. Tomorrow's your deadline. You have to, you know, and all of a sudden, no, you have another week or two. Wait a minute.
Most of that has come about, of course, because of the COVID pandemic and one side or the other going and saying, suing in court and saying this deadline is too short. We want it extended. And it's really been all over the board, whether the district courts or appeals courts have upheld what the states already have or whether they've extended it arbitrarily on their own. My view is it's the legislature's responsibility to make those changes, and those deadlines should be set by the legislature, and the courts should respect those deadlines. We have a national ruling that says you can be registered up to 30 days beforehand so that you can't, in other words, push registration back a year. But beyond that, I think it's up to the states to decide how long they want to allow registration to stay open and how they handle the absentee voting.
Yeah, I think it's a little, that part is becoming very confusing for a lot of people. And I used to work the elections. I was an election judge, and I'm like scratching my head going, now what are they doing?
Now what are they doing, yeah.
It doesn't make sense. So
that's, go ahead.
The election crimes, is there, Andy, a pattern? Can we go back in history and say, oh, that happened then too? Or is some of this stuff just brand new?
Some of the traditional election crimes, voter intimidation and ballot fraud, those have been around probably since the first vote was cast and the first presidential election going back through history. But of course, with the advances in technology, the enhanced or increased use of the internet, it's made it a lot easier for our foreign adversaries to engage in some of these types of election crime violations, in particular the malign foreign influence operations. 20 years ago, there just simply wasn't a platform or a method for our foreign adversaries to push out misinformation on this sort of national level or scale that they can do so now through the use of social media platforms and whatnot. So our adversaries are absolutely taking advantage of technology and using it for nefarious purposes to expand their use of these, of certain types of election crimes, which rely on technology to commit those crimes.
Well, I was surprised a couple of weeks ago, we had Alan on from InfraGuard, and he was talking about even Wikipedia. And I thought Wikipedia was like an encyclopedia. He goes, no, it's full of bad information. I'm like, wait, what?
So, and that goes back to what I talked about earlier in terms of some of those foundations for media literacy, is just because you read something one place, even if it's a vetted, credible news media platform, sometimes news media platforms get it wrong as well. Their sources are inaccurate. Maybe they're biased in their reporting, whatever it is. Just like Jim said earlier, you need to go and not just focus on one particular platform to get your news. Look at multiple different platforms to get different perspectives and to verify the information that you read on a particular news platform, even if it's a credible news platform.
That's so true. And I've been telling people forever, you know, switch it up, switch stations, hear what everybody's saying, because otherwise it's kind of like a brainwashing. Oh, this is true. They lied. I'm like, no.
Well, it's very easy for us to fall into that trap of just wanting to hear what reinforces our point of view, what we already have as our viewpoint. And so we listen, whether it's on the radio or through the internet or television, we just focus on that that's going to reinforce that point of view. And that's a lazy voter. That's a lazy intellectual mind that doesn't want to challenge what they're thinking. You've got to challenge that and get different points of view.
That's true. And I, you know, telling people all these new names that you've never heard of before, that, you know, all over town, there's these posters. And who are these people? Look them up. Find out what their social media says about them. Figure out what they're about before you go voting a straight ticket. And, you know, you used to be the only Republican I ever voted for. So I always voted for you because I just thought you had it together. You were there for the community. You weren't self-serving. And there's so much of us right now that I feel it's self-serving. And you watch some of the ads. At the end of the ad, they're supposed to put down who's sponsoring that ad. And it's squished together. It's micro, you know, small. You can't read it. And it's only on the TV for like a nanosecond. So you don't know who's promoting whatever they're promoting for that particular ad. And I think that needs to change because
only if the ad is coming from the campaign itself does it have the moniker at the end that this is Jim Colby or this is Donald Trump, this is Joe Biden, and I approve this message. That's the only ones you know that is coming from that campaign. But then you have all these other
special
political action committees and interest groups that are doing these campaigns, and they have totally innocuous names that don't tell you anything at all Americans for Good Government or whatever it might be. And so you have no clues what it is. And yet they have very, very distinct points of view, because they probably have somebody's bankrolling them with several million dollars and putting these ads on. So transparency, I think, is important, that we need to know that, who these people are. But I think we need to know where their money for those organizations is coming from.
And, you know, sometimes common sense helps. If it looks like it's been photoshopped, then it probably was. And the sound bites, the one ad has sound bites, and they put the sound bites together to make it sound like this person said a sentence. And it's just so misrepresentative of everything.
Well, you have to take things and you put it in their context. You take just a little bite, as you say, a sound bite out of a paragraph, and just take a few words, it could give it a completely different meaning than if you read the whole thing.
Oh, they did it to Dr. Fauci.
Yeah,
they totally misrepresented him.
That's a good example of it, exactly.
So the trends are they getting worse, Andy? Are things getting worse as far as the election? Is this a special office in the FBI trying to keep up with it?
Things are definitely starting to heat up as we get closer to the election, which is not a surprise. I mean, that's typically what we've seen over the last couple election cycles, especially when we're talking about malign foreign influence operations. And it's the FBI is taking sort of a multifaceted approach in order to counter election crimes in general, but again, the focus being on malign foreign influence operations. Since we've been working traditional election crimes for decades, we're quite good at that. So we've already got a good sort of infrastructure in place within the FBI in terms of our partnership with the Justice Department, as well as our local U.S. attorney's offices. So we've got what we call election crimes coordinators assigned to all 56 FBI field offices, and they are responsible for, among other things, investigating any types of election crimes. So again, that traditional election crime infrastructure is a well-oiled machine, been in place for a long time. I'm one of the election crime coordinators in the FBI Tampa division, and I've been going through training and having regular conference calls associated with all types of election crimes. But then, like I said earlier, this malign foreign influence operations is a relatively new thing. I mean, it was around before the 2016 election, but that's where it really sort of came to prominence and became much more widely known from a public perspective. And so to counter these malign foreign influence operations, the FBI established a Foreign Influence Task Force. And the Foreign Influence Task Force is located at FBI headquarters, and that entity consists of representatives from all four major FBI operational divisions at headquarters, which would include the Criminal Investigative Division, Counterintelligence Division, Counterterrorism Division, and Cyber Division. So we have individuals from all four of those components that work very closely with the Department of Justice prosecutors, specifically to coordinate the FBI's efforts when it comes to countering malign foreign influence.
So what happens when you find out somebody did something? Do they go to jail? I mean, they're not here. They're probably in Russia or wherever. They're someplace else. So you find out who did it, like the 13 people you're talking about, are they here in this country and you're, you know, taking them to court, or are they someplace else and they've just been indicted?
It's both. It depends on the circumstances. We do see election crimes violators here in the United States, again, more for your traditional election crimes, like I talked about, voter suppression and intimidation and ballot fraud and whatnot. But then for people that engage in disinformation operations, most of those are foreign actors. So if that's the case, they're often outside of the reach of U.S. law enforcement. So we'll do an indictment if they're not in the United States. Typically, what we'll do, and this depends on the specifics, and it's up to the investigative team how they want to handle it. But typically, they'll put out what we call an Interpol red notice. So that's essentially an arrest warrant that is placed in Interpol, which is the international police group. And that way, if one of these individuals who has been indicted travels to a country which has an extradition treaty with the United States, then that individual will be arrested and then can be extradited to the United States to face charges.
Sherry, that's right. I mean, these people are, this latest round, for example, of indictments, they're all in Russia, and aren't going to get our hands on them. But if they do travel, then we have a chance of getting them, and so they're really basically going to be confined to Russia. The other thing that, of course, we can do is if they have any assets elsewhere, we could try and freeze those or seize those or put sanctions against them, economic sanctions against these groups or individuals.
So what if it's a candidate misrepresenting somebody or something?
You mean a candidate here in this country?
Right.
Well, if they're misrepresenting something, they're not going to be subject to indictment there. That's not the same as this kind of thing we're talking about where they're spreading disinformation. I mean, as long as we've had political campaigns in this country, we've had people putting out falsehoods. You can go all the way back to the first elections and see the kinds of things that were said in those days. But so it's not a new kind of thing. And there again goes back to what both Andy and I were saying earlier, that it's up to you to sort through all of this and say, wait a minute, this claim by this candidate doesn't sound very valid to me. Let me check this thing out. And that's part of being a good voter, isn't just going to the polls on election day and voting, but going to the polls on election day and voting in an informed way, knowing
yes.
who you're voting for and why you're voting.
Yes, exactly. Okay, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be back in a few.
This is Nathan Chabon, producer for Law Matters. I have a goal to reach and I need your help. I want to put the DEA out of business. That's right, the Drug Enforcement Agency. If you have an addiction problem or know someone who does, please reach out to lawmatters1030.org and click the DEA tab for more information. Reaching out is the first step. We have the resources if you have the will. You can beat this demon and help me put the Drug Enforcement Agency out of business.
Hi, this is Sherry. If you think your current interest rate is high and refinancing is on your mind, give me a call at 520-310-9900. Maybe you're thinking about purchasing a new home while rates are low. Give me a call at 520-310-9900. Perhaps you just want to know how a reverse mortgage can improve your life. Give me a call at 520-310-9900. I can help you with all your mortgage needs, and I look forward to hearing from you. Thanks.
To report suspected human trafficking, please call the National Human Trafficking Resource Center at 1-888-373-7888 or text HELP or INFO to 233-733. To learn more about Homeland Security investigations and our efforts to combat human trafficking, please visit our website at www.ice.gov or check out the DHS Blue Campaign at www.dhs.gov/bluecampaign. For more information on the Southern Arizona Anti-Trafficking Unified Response Network, please visit us at www.saturn.org or find us on Facebook.
This is Nathan Chabon, producer for Law Matters Live Show, airing Saturday mornings at 8, when our listeners ask questions of the people who have answers. This is your show. If you have a show idea, go to lawmatters1030.org for our contact information. And we can't do it without your support. Please go to lawmatters1030.org to contribute. If you miss us live, check out Law Matters on iTunes, Google Play, lawmatters1030.org, and of course, kvoi.com. Now get your questions ready and join our conversation at 790-2040. We thank you.
Okay, thanks for staying with us. I want, Andy, can you tell people where to go to see the videos about Protect Your Voice? I know they're online. I know we have them on our website, but you have them on yours too.
That's right. So the FBI has a website as part of the FBI.gov public website, specifically for Protective Voices, and that website address is www.fbi.gov/investigate/counterintelligence/foreign-influence/protected-voices. So that's a mouthful, but if you just go in and type into your search bar, FBI Protected Voices Initiative, it should take you to this website. And there's quite a few videos on there that talk about foreign influence. They talk about the different aspects of foreign influence, some of which I've touched upon here. And it also gives you some recommended cybersecurity measures that you can put into place to help protect your IT system, whether you're a political candidate or a government agency or even a private company for that matter. So there's just some great resources on that website. In addition, the FBI over the last two or three weeks has issued a series of bulletins related to various election crimes, most of which are cyber-focused. And some of those bulletins have been published in conjunction with the Department of Homeland Security's Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA. So again, there's an FBI website that lists all of those different bulletins that have put out there. And it's, again, the easiest way is just to go and do an internet search for FBI election crimes and security, and that will take you to this webpage, again, on FBI.gov that's specifically dedicated to election crimes and security. And on the right-hand side of that, it says FBI election news, and there's links to these seven press releases, public service announcements that the FBI have put out over the last couple weeks.
And that's part of, you know who your resource is, where you're getting your information, whether it's credible or not. I like that.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things you'll see, the format that these PSAs or public service announcements take is that they include a section, most of them do, on recommendations. And there's several consistent themes. Regardless of the subject matter of that particular PSA, they always tell you to rely on established government websites to gain information related to the election, whether that means election results, any issues related to a particular polling location, anything like that. You should rely on those government websites for that information.
Yeah, don't.
Sherry, just one thing I'd add to all this. We were talking earlier about how our election procedures in this country and processes are very diffused. They're scattered all over different states and counties and cities all over the country. In one sense, that's actually a benefit to us in terms of a lot of countries. The real concern is interference, where they'll hack into the system and actually change election results or destroy voter registration rolls. Here, there are literally tens of thousands of those place sites for our voting and voter registration rolls and where the ballots are counted. So there's less opportunity for this to actually interfere in the election day process itself and the counting of the votes. But everything that Andy's been talking about and we've been talking about here is about disinformation leading up to that election, the kind of disinformation that the other side can try to spread and does spread. In order to try to convince people to vote differently. But I think we should have some good confidence that on election day, we're going to have a fairly solid election process and that the votes will get counted, even if they are a bit slow getting counted.
Yeah, I think there's a lot more people registering to vote and have incentive and personal interest for voting this particular election. So there's going to be a lot of ballot. I'm glad I'm not working the election, be honest with you. I'm just like, oh, okay.
That, of course, is one of the problems they have this year, but is that election workers generally have been older people, and with COVID, those people are not very willing to go out and work on election day. So I know in a lot of locations, I think in Arizona, they're scrambling to try to get enough people for election day poll workers, but since so many people are voting by absentee ballots, the need for having large staffs at these places will probably be somewhat reduced.
Yeah, I think Ann Rodriguez said that they're tapped out. They have all the people they need. And
oh, that's good.
In fact, I mailed my ballot in. I followed my ballot. I mailed it in after the show on a Saturday, and they had it by Tuesday. Sunday and Monday were, no mail days.
Right.
And they had it by Tuesday, and 3 days later, it was already put in a batch to be counted.
Yeah, it's really very good. You can go right online, and that's another thing people can do if they've mailed their ballot in. They can go to the election site there and at the Pima County Recorder's Office, and it'll tell you your ballot has been received, and then it'll tell you, okay, your ballot has actually been processed. In other words, they checked the signature, and it's in the pile to be counted on election day.
And I haven't really checked it after that part. Does it tell you it's been counted at some point? Will it say, okay, your ballot was counted?
Well, it's counted when you start to see the results. But now it's told you that your ballot is in the ballot box, basically.
Right.
You have your ballot, it's in the ballot box. Yes. And so they count those starting on election day, so they get processed and counted and reported at the same time as the other people who vote on election day. However, there are a lot of late arrivals of those absentee ballots. We saw the results of that in this last election in 2018, where at the end of the night, it appeared that Martha McSally was winning the race for Senate by about 50,000 votes. But in the end, after the absentee ballots had been counted, she lost by about 15,000 votes. So those that came in later and got counted later.
And I think there's a misconception, and I don't know if Andy can answer this or not, but when I was working the election, you had so many ballots, you know, provisional ballots and all these extra things. Everything had to be counted for. I mean, you had to be responsible for everything. If something was missing, you were in deep doo-doo. You had to make sure these ballots were there, whether they were a ruined ballot, or, you know, it had to stay there. You couldn't just throw it away. And I hear this all the time. People, oh, they're going to throw my ballot away. No, they don't throw it away. They have to save it.
And that's a great point. And we've partnered at the local level as well as at the national level with some of our law enforcement partners, including the U.S. Postal Inspection Service, which has responsibility for tracking all these ballots. And they provided training to us that has given a lot of insight into their very sophisticated computer tracking system, which, as Jim was talking about, that is used by the local election officials to show the status of your ballot. But likewise, the post office, as it's transiting through the mail system, both when you're receiving it and then when you mail it in, they have very sophisticated methods to track where your ballot is located. So they can identify if a bunch of ballots go missing in a particular area along a particular route, for example. They've got a lot of statistical information that they can capture as part of this software system that they have into place that allows for identifying any problems and then seeing if there's any malicious activity associated with any kind of lost ballots or anything like that. And I think that's something that the general public isn't necessarily aware of. They think that, you know, these ballots just are sort of in a black hole once they go into the mailbox. You know, once you drop yours off in at a post office for after you filled it out, and it's in some mysterious black hole where there's no way to track it. And that's absolutely not correct. Those ballots are tracked, and this software keeps track. And you can imagine there's millions of ballots that we're talking about being tracked. But the post office has this very robust system in place to track your ballots, which should give people some level of satisfaction that their ballot will in fact be counted.
So I want to talk about a little bit about campaign finance crimes. Do people have to be totally responsible for the money coming in? I know candidates constantly send out emails saying, send us your money. And I always say, you know, after a while, maybe you should start using coupons. But it's just crazy how much money some of these people are getting in the way they're spending it. Is there a rule, and does the FBI follow campaign funds?
Absolutely, and that's one of the four main types of election crimes that the FBI investigates. And those campaign contribution limitations are captured under the FECA, the Federal Election Campaign Act, and that limits how much individuals and companies can give to political campaigns as well as political candidates. It regulates the activities of political action committees. It prohibits certain types of donors from making any campaign contributions. That would include labor organizations, government contractors, and any kind of foreign sources, whether that's individuals, companies, or governments. So those are all prohibited from donating any money to political candidates or to political parties. And now there's also super PACs, which are very different than PACs, and those are a relatively recent addition to the political system. Super PACs are not limited in terms of donations like regular PACs are. or individuals or companies in terms of how much they can donate to a campaign. But the big limitation or restriction on super PACs is that they are prohibited from coordinating in any way with a political campaign or candidate. So Jim mentioned earlier, you'll see at the end of a political ad many times, I'm Andy Sakella and I approve this message. You will not see that on any ads that are paid for by super PACs, because that is a direct violation of the FECA, because they are not allowed to coordinate or have any communication with political candidates or individuals.
Let me just add to that, Sherry, that I think the weakness in the law is that it doesn't, we really don't know who's contributing to those super PACs. While I'm not in favor of trying to limit what people can contribute to them, I think we should know if there's a super PAC, as there is, that's supported by, let's say, George Soros, and largely supported by him, we should know that it's his millions of dollars that is going into that. We should know that it's Bloomberg that's putting $100 million into campaign in Florida under a name of a super PAC that you wouldn't identify his name with it there at all. But we should know where that money is coming from. But the amount of money that's coming in, even aside from the super PACs and the PACs, the amount of money is coming into campaigns and the political action committees, their political action committees, is absolutely staggering this year. You have in South Carolina, you have the Senate candidate there. South Carolina is a smaller state than Arizona. You have this candidate there that has raised over $100 million so far, and still raising that money there. So it's just an enormous amount of money that's flowing into these campaigns these days. And we have court rulings that say you can't limit how much people are going to be able to spend of their own money on it. You can limit how much they can give directly to the candidate and how much they can give directly to a PAC, but these super PACs are very different, as Andy has pointed out.
So what's the limit from a regular PAC to a super PAC? Is there a limit? Is there a division line?
There's no limit. They don't give super PACs. PACs don't give to super PACs. But there's no limit on the super PACs, but there is a limit on how much I can give to you as a candidate, or I can give to the political action committee you've created to support you. There's a limit on how much there. It's $2,500 in a primary or general election.
So if somebody is running for office and all of a sudden they have $70,000 in their coffer and no explanation for that, where that money came from, isn't that something to be concerned about?
No, yeah, but they do have to report that. I mean, as a candidate,
yes,
my campaign amounts, I have to report every dollar that's received, who it's come from, and what their name and what their occupation is. That's a requirement of the law. And you have to, if they contribute, send a check in, and you don't have that information, you have to go out and ask them for it. You have to make an honest attempt by sending out a mailing or an email to say, please give us your occupation here. Who's your employer? Who's your occupation? What's your occupation here?
What if it's an organization that gives you a bunch of money? How do they track that?
Here's what I found.
You mean a PAC, a political action committee giving money?
Right.
Well, they give money to a political action. Again, if it's my political action committee that I've created for myself, there's a limit on how much individuals can give, and corporations can't contribute to those political action committees directly. They can have their executives or employees contribute, but they don't contribute as a corporation to those PACs.
Okay. All right.
But election law is election finance law is a very arcane business, of which several lawyers in this town of Washington have made a whole career out of it.
I can see that. So, Andy, tell us what the FBI does not investigate.
We are not the morality police. So we talked earlier about maybe false claims that one candidate makes against another. That is not something that the FBI investigates. We don't police the accuracy of what candidates say about or to one another. We also don't investigate violations of state and local election laws. So, for example, campaigning too close to a voting location. There are local regulations that limit how close somebody can be. If they're they're handing out flyers or have signs up favoring one particular candidate. We also don't prosecute what we would call, like we do prosecute crimes that involve vote buying, which, and we take a pretty broad definition when we talk about a thing of value that's paid to a voter, but we don't prosecute relatively minor violations. So, for example, if someone gives a person a stamp to put on a mail-in ballot, obviously there's some value attached to that stamp, but it's a nominal value. People that give rides to the polls for voters, that's not something that we would prosecute. Fake nominating petitions is another potential local or state violation that we don't prosecute. So it's got, in order for us to investigate a crime, it has to be a violation of federal election law. And there's several different types of those. Broadly speaking, it breaks down into ballot fraud, campaign finance violations, patronage offenses, and civil rights violations. So if it doesn't fall into one of those four categories, then it's not something that the FBI investigates. In addition, for us to have venue or jurisdiction, there's a number of different conditions that must occur, which includes the ballot must include a federal candidate. It involves a election official or a polling official that is abusing their position. It involves providing false information related to one's ability or eligibility to vote, or violations of federal campaign finance laws. So I talk about that one condition, which is a federal candidate has to be on the ballot. We had an allegation in Tampa a few years ago, and it involved the misuse of campaign funds by an individual, by a candidate, which would normally fall under a federal election violation, because in this case, the state laws didn't apply to this candidate, so they wanted to try to prosecute him federally, but there was no federal candidate on that ballot. So we didn't have federal jurisdiction then to prosecute that individual who was accused of misusing their campaign funds.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So it's really complex. It depends on the specific facts and circumstances, whether or not a federal law applies. And even if it does apply, whether the misconduct, the alleged misconduct, is serious enough to warrant a federal investigation.
And it takes taxpayers' money to investigate these, so it has to be worth it.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I think just to simplify it, just keep in think that the FBI and the Justice Department is responsible for or has a jurisdiction to investigate and to prosecute where there's a federal crime that's involved and that involves federal law. If you have other election things going on in this county or at the ballot box, that would be largely up to the county attorney, the state attorney general, and election officials in the state and the county. So it's bifurcated, but that's the way our whole justice system has always been.
And as much as people talk about there should be national regulations and rules, having it by state and particularly by county pretty much limits any foreign adversary to take over our election. Because they'd have to be really busy.
As I said earlier, I think that's true on election day. There are people who throw up their hands and say it's just too confusing that we have states that have different times for registration, different times in which you can cast your ballot, a whole different voting systems, of course. It's amazing the number of different voting systems, from paper ballots to electronic to punch ballots to all kinds of things, that we've gone through different kinds of systems here. And that's, again, up to the states and sometimes up to local municipalities or counties to decide what kind of a system they're going to contract with to provide their voting system there. But that's the way it is in this country. And I don't think we're going to see us go to a national election law anytime soon. I think that's probably not in the cards.
Okay. But do you think they're going to come up with some rules about how you campaign and how you behave? My question, we had the attorney on from the Federal Election Commission on a couple of weeks ago, and one of my questions was, how do they, they vet the FBI, the DOJ, all these people have to go through credit check, they're on the lie box, they're lie detector test. They take exams. I mean, they're totally vetted, but you can become the president of the United States, and the different parties aren't necessarily seriously vetting their candidates.
That's correct. We don't do that. That's the whole concept of our democracy and election system, is that the voters make that decision. That's why
getting, I think, good, they should at least go through a psych evaluation.
Well, I could confirm that that's probably true for some candidates that I've known through the years, but we don't require that. We don't require a psych evaluation. That's, again, I think that's one of the hallmarks of our election system, is that voters make that decision. They don't have to be approved. Like in Russia recently, at their recent elections there, they just made sure that these candidates they didn't want didn't get on the ballot. And in Hong Kong, they did the same thing. They ruled off most of the protesters because they had been arrested for some reason. And so they said, you can't be on the ballot here. But that's not the case in the United States.
Well, I think there should be some type of vetting system. It just doesn't make sense.
Well, that's what you do. That's what you do, Sherry, with the media. You vet the people and make sure the people know about them.
Now I feel like I've got a burden on my shoulders. So, Andy, we only have a couple of minutes left. What do you want to tell the people, the listeners, to do to feel better about this voting?
I want folks to know that we have officials at all levels of government, federal, state, and local, that are working around the clock to ensure the safety and integrity of our election system, to make sure that your vote counts. So you should rest assured that we are doing everything that we can to protect your vote. But I also want to reiterate what I talked about before with media literacy, which is when you consume information on the internet, and it doesn't just apply to the election, it's for anything, don't believe everything you read. Check it out and make sure that information is accurate before you use that to make any kind of a decision, especially when casting your vote. Report any type of suspicious activity to your local FBI field office. If you see a suspicious post on a social media platform, most social media platforms have methods of reporting that, because the FBI has been working closely with social media platforms to make sure that any foreign actors who are masquerading as U.S. citizens, for example, that those accounts are shut down. So there are reporting mechanisms on those social media platforms. And if you see something that you think is suspicious that is posted by someone who is from another country, report that to the social media platform as well as to your local FBI field office.
Okay.
Sherry, I would just add, make people feel good about their voting. Vote early. Get your ballot in as soon as possible. Don't delay.
Absolutely. They keep moving the goalposts, so don't delay. Get it in before they move the goalpost again. So I want to thank both of you for coming on. I know it's almost lunchtime there for both of you.
That's right. So, okay, thank you very much for having us.
Yeah, thank you for coming on and educating us. I learned something every time I talk to you. And I want to remind everybody that if you've missed a podcast or missed a show, you can go to iTunes. Our podcasts are on iTunes. And, of course, the Law Matters website, lawmatters1030.org. Everything is on there. And all the FBI information that we talked about is also on the lawmatters1030.org website. Until next week, I want everybody to stay safe, shop local, vote. Talk to you next week.